Thank you, and I'm thrilled to be here. I'm on my own sort of virgin tour of sorts, and I'll be going to AMS in the fall. And this comes out of work in my dissertation where I thought I would write on a number of Madonna songs, and then I got to 250 pages, and my advisor said, go ahead and stop. And so at this point rate, I'll be writing well into the afterlife on her. Several years ago, in 2005, the pop singer Madonna penned an essay titled Memories for a collection celebrating the late artist Keith Haring, a friend and collaborator. One of the more emblematic visual artists of the 1980s, Haring died prematurely of complications from AIDS in 1990. Madonna writes, quote, from the very beginning, there was a lot of innocence and a job that was coupled with a brutal awareness of the world, but it was all presented in a childlike way. The fact is, there's a lot of irony in Keith's work, just as there's a lot of irony in my work, and so often, his art deals with sexuality, and it's a way to point out people's sexual prejudices, their sexual phobias. End quote. This excerpt reveals much of the aim of the political content behind Madonna's work. Though she came quickly to the limelight in 1983, her background and the artists she worked with in 1970s, 80s New York saw shared motivation for artistic interpretations that fought against the hard-handed moralizing of groups like the Reverend Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority, a religious grassroots political organization founded to heal perceived decay of the nation's morality, decay Falwell saw emanating from the successes of the civil rights movement, second wave feminism, and the LGBT rights movement. Madonna came to signify a crucial generational figure to young women growing up beyond the reaches of the 60s sexual revolution, but who desired to hear themselves in the modes of desire possible in a period that saw re-emergent political discourse over the moral naturalization of gender roles and sexuality as the tide of the counterculture receded. This paper will unpack the girl sound Madonna cultivated in her first number one hit, Like a Virgin, a voice that sings against the grain of this 80s discourse. We will look retrospectively to 60s politics through the love songs of African-American girl groups whose sonic optimism masked underlying social inequalities. This project analyzes Like a Virgin as a cultural artifact that articulated a new feminist mode and undermined cultural nostalgia for false norms of the late 50s and early 60s. Despite Madonna's political underpinnings, music critics quickly discarded Like a Virgin. People magazine declared the song a tolerable bit of fluff, while the year-end review published in Rolling Stone relished the song's whipped cream tastiness, only to dismiss the song as merely spectacle. However, this pop fluff bubblegum aesthetic, shaped predominantly by Madonna's carefully affected girl sound, foregrounded a powerful challenge to growing reactionary political movements. 2 years prior, in 1982, Phyllis Schlafly's staunch advocacy for the preservation of traditional gender roles scuttled the momentum of the Equal Rights Amendment that had built up throughout the 70s. Schlafly believed the constitutional mandate would lead inexorably to gay marriage, and furthermore, the collapse of the natural institution of marriage and society itself. But marriage had already undergone a major revision. Long-held matrimonial conventions had been uprooted over the prior decade as no-fault divorce, first enacted by California Governor Ronald Reagan in 1969, became a plausible legal avenue for the dissolution of marriage. No-fault divorce continued to spread across the country until reaching all but two states by 1983, South Dakota and New York. 1 year later, Madonna's sonic fluff would ignite a critique of marital authenticity. On his debut at the inaugural MTV Video Music Awards on September 14th in 1984, Madonna explicitly connected Like a Virgin to marriage, an institution then undergoing legal and cultural struggles for redefinition through a live vocal performance that shed any pretense about the dream of bridal purity and idealized romance. This amplified the song's celebration of the artifice around the social construction of virginity, an artifice that has sonic ancestry with similar political motives in disco and punk, genres that dismantle the guise of authenticity in the rock movement. And this is something explored by Alice Eckel in her recent book on disco. But less than 1 month later, President Reagan won re-election as the Republican incumbent took 49 of 50 states on the strength of significant economic recovery. The decisive election firmly established the Reagan era as the president declared mourning in America over the course of his powerful campaign. When Madonna appeared on top of that fake white cake, awash in purple and pink lighting, Italian-American and Catholic heritage in tow, she stepped into a political pressure cooker that would define her virgin era. Like a virgin, Madonna's sophomore effort marked a departure from the recording of her debut effort, the self-titled Madonna. The Madonna album featured a mashing of the singer's club songs from post-disco New York that represented the migration of a young woman to the big city through references to funk, new wave, and punk, genres that define the amalgamation of sound that straddled 70s, 80s culture in a city besieged by urban decay. The protagonist of Madonna's romantic songs found love in the disco, Holiday, on the rock stage, Burning Up, and wandering the streets, Borderline. Unlike Madonna, the Like a Virgin album was produced entirely in-house at Power Station Studio in Manhattan under the guidance of producer Nile Rodgers and engineer Jason Corsaro. Having witnessed astonishing success with her debut, Sire Records gave Madonna all the trappings of a fully staffed studio and free creative control to develop a unified concept for her next album. Furthermore, the record company offered a catalog of demos from which Rodgers and Madonna could choose. Differing from her debut album, where she mostly featured singles from her club performances, Madonna instead created an album that framed itself around the title track, Like a Virgin, a song from the songwriting duo of Billy Steinberg and Tom Kelly. Madonna's vocal timbre shifted from the belting young woman of her debut album to a more affected girl sound that shaped interior romantic narratives within Dreams in songs like Material Girl and Angel. The principal musical feature in the backing track that pulls us into these dream worlds comes from the running synth line that undergirds most of the songs. The use of the synthesizer to clearly demarcate subdivisions of the beat, often through a walking or running bass, maintains a dramatic pulse that, tempered by the especially sharp timbre of the notes themselves, creates the bouncy, albeit pointed, motion that frames the narrative. Madonna's girl sound has significant historical precedent in African-American girl groups who came onto the charts in the early 1960s. The girlish temperament that shapes this album finds a footing with simpler bass lines, rather than the funk inflection of her debut effort, and an alignment with Motown through producers Nile Rodgers, who had recently worked on Diana Ross's hit album, Diana. Though both of Madonna's early albums make extensive use of the synthesizer, Virgin fuses synthesized lines with the dependence on drummer Tommy Thompson's emphatic rock sound, especially in the title track, thus embracing a place between nostalgia for the 60s girl group sound and an 80s mix of synth pop and rock. This sonic background moves the Like a Virgin album away from the politics of funk and disco and toward romantic narratives of black women in the 60s that sit somewhat uncomfortably within their sonic bonds. This narrative and shift in sound powered the album's rise into the top 10 of Billboard's R&B chart, thus marking a 46-week run unmatched by either of the albums that came before or after Like a Virgin. Though Madonna's pivot to girl groups in Motown might at first seem nostalgic, consider the powerful political discourse within these love songs. For they, too, like Virgin, can be mistakenly considered pop fluff instead of acknowledging the uncomfortable romantic narratives they sew into seemingly lighthearted sonic palettes. In her study of 60s girl groups, Jacqueline Warwick considers narratives of sexual violence that are often backed by sweet-sounding soundscapes. Take, for example, the Shirelles' Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, 1960, the Cookies' Chains, 1962, and the Crystals' He Hit Me and It Felt Like a Kiss, 1962. Each song presents deep tensions around romance reflected historically in the turbulence of the ongoing civil rights movement. Listening to Like a Virgin, we can hear a similar motive about the violation of a young woman's heart. The juxtaposition with narratives of love, often quite more foreboding than their musical production might indicate, and danceable tunes, foregrounds the body in Like a Virgin through the tinny, breathy sound of Madonna's voice, a performed anxiety over the body both sung, then by the 24-year-old singer, and danced by a body much more mature than the voice we hear. Translated to the 80s, these fears point to the ongoing public debate over abortion, pornography, and the false link of AIDS to promiscuity and poor morals. Let us consider then how these fears emerge in Like a Virgin's narrative. Notice that the protagonist sings of a love that does not exist. She intentionally obfuscates history as a way to create an imagined realm of romance that insulates her from a troubled, distant past. Her description of that love is especially vague. The protagonist presents us with few material attachments. The song lacks markers of place. The girl's relative place and time continuously slips between past, present, and a middle ground of past, present. The sonic signifiers of happiness in the song, a buoyant, girlish nasality, a speedy, bouncy, synthesized bass line, and the melody's savoring elongation of the word virgin, work to submerge the listener in the singer's effusive embrace. And yet, the protagonist nearly smothers us with joy only to withhold key details. Who is this boy who has brought her such joy? And how are we meant to understand her past? Listen initially for a couple points. First, notice how the opening chords and the introduction dodge between strong and weak beats of the measure. Second, hear the way the melody in the first verse avoids establishing a stable subject until the final line, which is indicated on the screen. And lastly, look for the way puns are rhythmically highlighted in the second verse of the song. Certain passages in the song stand out for the way they play with time. The protagonist partially describes a love she has found while simultaneously withholding part of her love. Quote, gonna give you all my love, boy, end quote. That is to say, you have not earned it quite yet. And my fear is fading fast, suggesting that she is steadfast between rejection and acceptance. But then she persists, you're so fine and you're mine. I'll be yours till the end of time. In the second example, she has moved to complete acceptance. However, this linear shift is not one the song necessarily upholds. Even the sentiment, only love can last, belies the very first thing the song tells us about love. I was sad and blue, scared and cold, and lost in the wilderness. Tenses and emotions alike are decidedly mixed. These are not the descriptions of virginal innocence or romantic inexperience. They more closely resemble admonitions to a youthful, especially female audience. The protagonist comes from a place of romantic pain that she seeks to resolve, and over the course of the song, she fantasizes this pain to resolution. Let us not be shy, however. The fantasy is a sexual one. I do not mean to avoid the obvious and humorous sexual undertones, or, as typified by Madonna's performance on the record, overtones. The song rests on the very play of virginity as a piece of sexual gossip. Indeed, the very idea of being like a virgin, the very idea of being like a virgin suggests a waggish impropriety. Madonna works to undermine a stable idea or nostalgia for virginity. There's a sexual play at work reflected in the vocal performance of the song itself. The high-pitched hays and low-pitched ohs articulate a range of pleasures that come to mock sexual convention and interrogate 80s discourse around the naturalization of sex. Not only does this sexual play, which implies a mode of pretense, elicit self-deprecating humor, it is, after all, a difficult pretense to pull off effectively, if at all, since the sexual knowledge embodied in the voice of the singer almost immediately suggests otherwise. But it also calls attention to the extreme awkwardness of sexual encounter itself. If romantic interest in the story exists not at all in the sparse account of their encounter, then it exists only within the mind, thus bringing autoeroticism to the forefront of the song. We can link here to the 60s girl group motive of fantasizing over an absent lover, will you still love me tomorrow? In the case of Like a Virgin, essentially the 80s sequel to Carole King's eponymous hit, we might ask, can I ever love again? The vocal double tracking of the chorus features a replication of the protagonist singing alongside herself and luxuriating mostly, most emphatically on the word virgin. If this humorous sexual play sits on the surface of the song, then what does the facade mean to protect? The song's narrative suggests certain inconsistencies, those that are not entirely covered by humor's mask. The alliance of humor and fear, must not be considered at odds. The strategic narrative trope, particularly irony, stands in as a defensive mode that we heard Madonna earlier indicate was central to critiquing sexual phobia. This points to Madonna's role in 80s feminist discourse. In 1990, Camille Paglia pronounced Madonna the future of feminism in the New York Times. Paglia jabbed at the sex phobia of second-wave feminists who chastised the singer, beginning with Virgin, for pushing the sexual envelope too far. We can leave most of Paglia's anti-feminist brouhaha at the curb. Her ideas, after all, contributed to disturbing claims of the natural role of the sexes that was closer to Falwell than feminist discourse. But what we should take from Paglia's claim is the focus on Madonna's desire for sex-positive discourse, a notable alliance with third-wave feminism, something the singer discussed quite openly in early interviews. Consider the way Madonna expresses her own struggles with convention as a young woman growing up in Michigan. In this slide, we see how Madonna dealt with the imbalance of gender relations in her youth. That one's body could become a source of shame, something she clearly worked very hard to resist, seems to have driven her to work against allowing such a social discomfort control. These sentiments and the song itself conjure the dichotomy of virgin and whore that is inevitably tied up in the Catholic identity of the singer herself. Perhaps Madonna's most recognizable title of the 80s, the ironic boy toy moniker debuted at the 84 VMAs, came from her early days in New York, where artist Keith Haring immortalized the phrase for the singer on a jeans jacket. Though it has garnered meanings outside of its ironic intention, the term succeeded in unnerving spectators who knew that Madonna was hardly ever going to be subservient to their desires or gaze. Thus, we see how Madonna employs strategies that come to be a crucial block of feminist discourse. The singer denies the virgin whore dichotomy, thus constantly rejecting naturalized modes of femininity and desire that were the province of reactionary 80s discourse. These naturalized modes, false narratives drawn from nostalgia for late 50s and early 60s culture, served as powerful archetypes for the social movements of Falwell and Schlafly. Such ideals, problematized in love songs of African-American girl groups, never existed. Madonna contests the love song through the sonic embodiment of 60s blackness and Like a Virgin to undermine this wave of nostalgia and the impossible demands it places on sexual propriety and thus on people themselves. Perhaps one of the most visible costs of such sexual phobia, the growing AIDS crisis, would take the life of many, including Madonna's colleague Keith Haring. And so we end where we began, in a moment of memory. Madonna sings against the grain from lived experience, not as popular fluff, but in the lesson of how we struggle with loss and how to love again through song. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ross. We have time for questions, and we're going to take a little bit more time to do for everything.
This kind of struck me with the song on this. How high is the voice? I mean, it's like Madonna on Helium.
Yes.
How much? I mean, she worked in New York for a long time, but she wasn't a teen star. She was in her mid-20s by the time she started to hit. I mean, is there kind of an apex that she's working on here? Because some of your later stuff, I guess, is a bow, is much more deeper.
Sure, no, it's something that comes explicitly here, because her first album, I mean, she's got a thinner voice, but you don't hear that nasality and that really intense pitching. You know, that very much is like, a song like Borderline is actually dramatically different in certain ways in terms of her range of expression. And so she pulls it out very powerfully here in Material Girl, where she invokes, of course, Marilyn Monroe, which is another important reference, right, to sexual conventions, and plays with that in this middle period. But then, of course, she goes, with the next album, then we're talking about Papa Don't Preach. It's a shift. And it's something that William Orbit, who worked with her on Ray of Light, actually talks about, not this explicitly, but when recording Ray of Light and work they did more recently, kind of talking about the expressive range she has with timbre and how she really will work to create different characters. And so you'll see that a lot. The one thing she'll contrast a lot with early stuff is she will do that kind of girl sound, childish voice, sometimes juxtaposed directly with a more adult voice. So Into the Groove does that, for example, or I'm forgetting the song for the moment, but there's a ballad, Unlike a Prayer, where she flips back between the two verses while actually talking and discussing kind of sexual violence. It'll come to me in a moment. And so sometimes she's employing these different characters even within songs, but definitely as a period moment, it's Like a Virgin where she does this.
Well, I have a question about some of the, you move the culture of the anthropologist, I'm really struck by your mention of the VMA Music Awards of 1984 because, of course, I haven't watched that in a while, but I sort of watched it this past term, and I was so struck by the dancing, which is so not what I associate with Madonna since, Truth or Dare and some of her videos then, about how seemingly intentionally sloppy it is. But I wonder, it's like, it is Madonna lying on the floor, reading around, humping the wedding dress. It is, obviously she's not a bad dancer. This is not like, she hasn't learned to dance yet because, she's dancing professionally before this.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit more about not just how she is taking on a particular vocal style as part of this, ironic move, but also the decisions that she's making about movement and choreography?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. She plays with it explicitly there, this intense exaggeration, I think, that's supposed to match the vocal affect and all these things. I mean, it draws to a certain extent on camp itself, though I don't know yet that it is camp. It will become that kind of in newer iterations. of this. And it's a level of humor that she often pulls out. And of course, part of it was supposed to tell us, to point us to the irony, like Material Girl's got to be one of the most frustrating songs of all time because people today still believe it's a celebration of materialism. You can't watch the video, you can't listen to that and believe that. That's actually physically impossible. And yet to this day, there are ways that those messages still get out there. And so it's like an early instance of her trying to show you the level of artifice here. I think the kind of extreme one. And from her account of it, all that was completely just kind of improvised. But yeah, I mean, you can't make the point any more explicitly than what she did in a certain way. And yet, even to this day, people don't know. And it's interesting, like, how she refashioned the song most lately is really quite stunning. It pulls out contrasts. On her most recent tour, she sings it just with piano, like a virgin, but she drops the range. She puts a lament tetrachord underneath it. It's a different orchestration, or it is actually, of the song. And it actually brings out the failure part of romance narratives. And it's actually really quite brutal in a certain sense, because at the end of the song, she gets strung up in this corset. And so you see these flip sides. I guess the point is, sometimes you get this really intense, exaggerated humor, and then other times you see this kind of very serious, intense, dramatic narrative being put together. I don't know if that speaks to it, but yeah. So I, like you say, it's extremely purposeful. It's trying to unmoor kind of our convention for looking at something.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.